Good evening, and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Deborah Becker. Tonight, we have a lecture presented by the Institute for Human Sciences titled The Legacy of 1968, A European Perspective. Speaking will be European Parliament member and co-president of the Greens Free European Alliance Group, Daniel Cohn-Bendit. Introducing our speaker will be Harvard University professor Stanley Hoffman. We begin with a greeting by Institute for Human Sciences Executive Director Irina Grudzinska-Gross.
Welcome, everybody, to today's discussion, which is commemorating the events of 1968 in Europe. Our speaker today is Daniel Cohn-Bendit. He will be introduced by Professor Stanley Hoffman, whom in turn I will introduce. Allow me, however, to say a word about our main speaker before that. It is in relationship to the postcard and information that we mailed around. There's a short biography of our speaker, and it starts with a declaration. Daniel Cohn-Bendit is a German politician, and then it continues that he became famous in the 60s as Danny the Red, both on account of his politics and the color of his hair. And that he grew up in Germany and France and became a spokesperson and leader of the May Revolution in Paris. But it is kind of a mistake. We took it from the website, his website actually, because he is not only a German politician, he's a French politician as well, and the best way of describing him would be to say that he's a European politician. And the same adjective, European, applies equally to the second speaker we have here with us, Professor Stanley Hoffman. He was born in Vienna, grew up in France, and although he's in the United States, or to be specific, at Harvard, as of 1955, he's continuously working on European matters. He has founded and been the chairman of Harvard Center for European Studies till 1995. And at Harvard, he teaches, among other subjects, French intellectual and political history, American foreign policy, and post-World War II European history. He published numerous books and very influential article, and is working now on a book on Albert Camus and on ethics in international affairs. So please, Professor Hoffman.
All good from here, Anna-Cara. I'll be very brief because one really doesn't need to introduce Daniel Cohn-Bendit. I have never thought about him, I confess, as a politician, which shows perhaps that I put politicians a little lower than I put him. If he is a politician, he's one of the very few who still has a utopian streak in him. And add to this that he has been influential not only in France and in Germany, but also all over Europe. He's a member of the European Parliament, a member of the co-president of the Greens Free European Alliance in the European Parliament. I had the great pleasure of meeting him a dozen years ago when he came to Harvard for a conference about France, Germany, and immigration, which would have been totally different without him, because he introduced into a conference which was marked by the presence of a number of officials a note of humor, intelligence, wit, and the art of deflating pomposity, the like of which I have rarely seen, and all of this are at the service of a very good cause, which is a cause of well, how should we put it, being humane towards immigrants and treating them like human beings, which is not something which always comes natural in any country. And then a couple of days later, he gave an extraordinary lecture about his version of, well, I will call it socialism, even if he doesn't accept it. But I was reminded of everything that was interesting and good of the early socialists, of people like Proudhon, and I particularly admired what he had to say about the need for nonviolence in politics and his distaste for violence, which was, after all, one of the many interesting aspects of May 68 in France, that it remained, despite the best efforts of some, a nonviolent movement. Well, we have very limited time, so I shall let him speak.
Good evening, and thank you, Stanley. And I remember this meeting because there I had the pleasure to meet, I remember, Juppé, who was at that meeting with his young girlfriend that he, in between, he married. But it was a quite funny debate because they had made new law and they prepared new law for immigration and this time. It was a real interesting in Harvard in this time. Now, tonight, I want to welcome all the white hair here. I'm sorry that I'm not redhead hair anymore. I have blonde hair, but it's the same that white hair. So, because if you have red hair, you become blonde, and if you are dark, you become white, you know? This is a way of history. These 40 years, 68, is very strange for me because I decided last year not to follow any invitation on the 60s and not to say a word. And I was really in, we had a family discussion and my son told me, come on, you can't every time, everybody knows what you say. So stay at home or stay in Brussels or stay in Strasbourg, play football, but don't spend your time on something that you don't need anymore to talk about. And then something happened. The former husband of Cecilia and the actual husband of Carla Bruni, in the last day of the electoral campaign, had a problem. And this problem, he loudly spoke out that he wanted to finish with the heritage of the 60s and 68. In French, he said, il faut liquider 68. Now, it's very difficult for me to accept to disappear. And so I was challenged, not only personally, but I think we were challenged. And the interesting thing of the discourse of Sarkozy was that think about something back in the society today, and if you want to know who is responsible for it, go to 68. So he has a very simple-minded way of history, but it is something who exists, and you know it from this country. You know you have a new sport in the last years, especially in the 60s, and it's something would function politically. I think here it began with Reagan, but you had a lot of people doing like this, and you had in Europe also, and you had, for example, when Joschka Fischer was foreign minister, you had it also in Germany. So that in this situation, I decided to respond. But now the problem is how to respond. How to respond that you don't fall in the trap of a nostalgia, and you don't fall in the trap of saying, yes, everything was terrible. So my first point is to tell you, forget 68. Forget 68 because we live in another world. But first I want to say, it was an incredible, exciting moment in our life. And it was a moment where we felt we were doing history. Not that history was coming on us, but in that time we could influence history, who changed a lot of things. Now we have to understand what did change, what did not change. But it is very important that we understand that you can only argue about 68 if you argue about the time in which it took place. It was not on the moon. It was not some in a non-historical moment. That it was a very precise moment. And the interesting thing is, if you think of the 60s and 68, you can't think of one country. And it's incredible. You take 6 and 8 and put 68, and wherever you go, Latin America, Northern Africa, United States, France, Germany, Warsaw, Prague, 68 talks to the history of all this region in the country. And the people, some with white hair, some without white hair, also young people, react on this. And, you know, it's incredible, you know, how it functioned. You know, and it's not because of me, but I'm always surprised, you know, that I'm recognized on the street in Brasilia, in Istanbul, in a country where it never was before. Because the picture, and you have the picture that we have, this picture is in a collective memory. It's not me. It is the memory of a generation who said, against power, you can fight with irony, you can fight, and you can really make the difference with it. So this is the interesting thing of the 60s. What did function all over the world? A lot of places in the world. And I think the first thing that you have to understand, I think we have to understand, it was the revolt of the generation born after the Second World War against the world of the people who were living in the Second World War. And I don't want to say that their world were completely bad. I just wanted to say they, after the Second World War, had a conception of life, of society, of moral, that was completely inadequate with the development, with the evolution of our society. And for this, even if it was completely different, communist countries like in Czechoslovakia in this time, or Poland, or others, and Germany or France, the gold system, and German Republic, you know, even if all these were completely different, the common moment was this moment of anti-authoritarian revolt against this world built after the Second World War, this type of society. So this is the common moment. And this is very important because you understand that it had a political dimension, but it had also a daily life dimension. A life dimension. It was, we want to take our life in our hands. We want the autonomy of our life. We don't want that the decision how we want to live is made outside of us. It's not an individualistic view of society. It is a view of autonomy, and this autonomy is an individual one and a collective one. So it is the right to, as an individual in a collective, decide about yourself. And this is very important to understand this, because I don't know if a lot of people here remember how was the society in the 60s. Because we are all used to live today, and it's right so. So I give you some example. I know some people have heard me before somewhere in Brandeis, so I'm sorry, because I can't always invent another example. But in France, 65, a married woman who wants to open a bank account or take a job need a written permission from her husband. This is a society of the 60s. Incredible today. You can't. Take university. University student building, student home. If you were caught as a man in a woman's building or the woman in a man's building after 9 o'clock in the evening, after 3 times, you could be expelled from the university. It was society where the collective moral of the society was a moral guided by an ideology of another century. And the new generation after the war didn't accept this type of authoritarian society. You had the Vietnam War. It was, in the Western world, a common reference. The revolt, the protest against the Vietnam War. But the protest against the Vietnam War was also, a lot of time here in the States, but also in the name of an idea what a free society should be. And the idea was, if we are a democracy, if we are a free society, we can't do this to the people in Vietnam. So it was with the idea of a certain responsibility, of a certain value of society that we had. This is one thing. The other thing was a revolt against the authoritarian structure in universities everywhere. How university was organized. The third one was to change the life. And there you have different form, you know. You had in the States, you know, to a lot of young people, it's my interpretation, you can say I'm right or wrong, is they want to flee from the dictatorship of the suburbs, you know, to have a life who is not the clean suburbs, the same house one near the others, you know. And the most, you know, the wish to have something else different than, of course, was symbolized in our memory by Woodstock. But Woodstock was not only a concert. Woodstock was, we want to live differently, and it's, I think Abby Hoffman was right when he talked about Woodstock Nation, because there he talked about something that, and you see the film, I mean, I saw a few months ago the film about Woodstock, if you look at it, this film, you will see also what really was this type of revolt and this non-violent dimension, you know. And one and I think, you know, that we forgot all this. We forgot that because this wish of another life went a lot of time wrong later, we forgot that how impressive this wish was. In Germany, you had a movement who were, okay, it was a movement against the Vietnam War. It was a movement against the responsibility of the German government towards a dictatorship in Iran. It was a responsibility of a government who supported the United States in Vietnam. This was one level. The other level was a critique of the structure of the university, old-fashioned authoritarian structure. And the last level was this, we want to live differently, but with a German component, which is quite impressive, or remained for me impressive. It is that this young generation of German, born after 1945, had history on their back. And they had, but it was abstract. It was not a debate for them about history. It was how to question my parents, how to question my grandparents. It's one thing to say, the German were guilty. It's another thing to say, my father, my mother, my granddad, and my grandma were guilty. And I discuss with them, and I round of the table with them. And I think this was a process in Germany who was quite complicated. It started in the 60s. It started before. But the generation who asked the question, and we can today, 40 years later, say that sometime this generation were unjust. They were unjust because they acted, they asked like, if we were born in this time, we wouldn't have made this mistake. And this nobody can say. Nobody can say how he would behave in a dictatorship if he is not in. And to pretend to be courageous is easy. To be really courageous is difficult. So, but putting this by side, this was the beginning of a debate in German society who continue with the American series, TV series Holocaust, where it was so disturbing the German society that after each moment they had to organize in TV a discussion. You had to stop the emotion in the families. Because there, you know, it was not only the student revolt, it was all the young people in their family asking their family, didn't you know? Didn't you see? So the German, this third component in the German society, was something who changed completely. And the end of this story is that after Willy Brandt in 69 came in power, and he went then later to Poland, when he fell on his knee before the monument of the ghetto of Warsaw, this was the result of an evolution of the German society. And of course, if you see the picture of Brandt in Warsaw, if you are a little bit kitsch like me, you have your tear in your eyes. It was an emotional reaction, but this emotional reaction has to do with his own history and with the history, the evolution of the debate in Germany. So this is also the 60s, another type of 60s, and it has to do with the German history. Now coming, I can't make every country because then tomorrow morning to breakfast we will we'll be there. So if you think I have forgotten something, is you're right, and but it is like this. Now I come to France also. Well, the interesting thing of France is the context was France of de Gaulle. France of de Gaulle was on one side an incredible economic growth. Incredible. And economical modernization of the country. On the other side, it was a completely authoritarian, closed society. For example, before every 8 o'clock news at television, 2 hours before, the development of the news was sent to the Élysée to look if they agree or not. And when the information minister, who was also the education minister, you know, wanted to say something in TV, he just took his phone and he say, "I come." And then he came. And then when he came, they asked him, "How long, Monsieur le Ministre, how long when you want to talk?" "I don't know." So he started. And during he started, De Gaulle said, De Gaulle means, De Gaulle this, De Gaulle that. And in this time, they have to change, you know, their program because they didn't know how long it will take, you know. TV was him. You think I invent something. No. So, for example, during all the first time of the movement, the TV weren't allowed to show any picture of the movement. So the first 2 weeks, you didn't see one picture of what happened in Paris street and university in the official French TV, and there was no other. The other two different things that exist were private radios. And this private radio had a direct live report on the street. So you had the radio who were telling you stories in demonstration, describing demonstration like a soccer game. The student forwards, the police back, the police forward, the student back, you know. And it was a sports reporter who were really there. And then suddenly, I can't talk anymore. There's too much gas and I have to go away. We laugh today. But all France were there, not seeing the picture, only in the ear. And of course, this made a big gap between the institutional government of France and the rest of France. And at that time, what was interesting is that this movement who started attacked the core of the organization of the French society after the Second World War. The core of the organization of French society after the Second World War was a common power on different level by the Gaullists, the state after 58, and the Communist Party on the working class. And this Gaullist-Communist agreement, the demonstration of it until now, is the French position on nuclear, energy, and defense, because it was handled by a public service called in France, EDF, who was financing years and years the Communist Party, and was in the hands of the state. And so when you had Chernobyl, you know, the responsible for nuclear energy went in TV to say how long it remains. Say in TV, he said to the French, "Keep cool, no problem. All what is in Europe doesn't occur France. You know, France is not touched by the fall down of Chernobyl because the nuclear problem knew the French border and they avoided the French border." When he makes his speech, no opposition, no communist opposition. It's impossible. All Germany was mad on this, all the other, only France was cool. This was the core. It's the core of the French society after the Second World War. And in 68, when it started, you had a very clear statement. One statement is, this German anarchist is a danger for the French student and for the French working class. Georges Marchais, L'Humanité, beginning of May, in the French Communist Party. And you have to now to hear to the sound. If in France you say, and 68 is only 23 years after the Second World War, German, danger for French, it is a sound for the French population. And you had the same sound in Minute, far right-wing newspaper. This, but they had a plus in the sound. This man, German, Jewish anarchist, is a danger for the French population. And when all this movement went through, and when you had all this movement, you know, you had also from De Gaulle, you know, the thinking is to put these rebels, La Chienlit, how you call it, you put them, you know, on the by side, they are not real good friends. So it was the same structure of argumentation. And what was interesting is in this movement, you know, that the student movement or the young movement, you know, opened a door. It was a rupture. The rupture that dreamed that the former husband of Cecilia and now husband of Carla Bruni, who dreamed for rupture, not in private case, but in political case, you know, he, you know, will say the rupture. This, the first big, you know, rupture was in this movement in the 60s. It was a rupture with all a French tradition, all a communistic tradition. And what is interesting that after a certain moment, and this is a unique dimension of what happened in France, suddenly young workers started the movement in factory, not trade union. The trade union were against. It were young workers, and one factory after the others started to strike. And after it was more than 200, of course, the trade union had to say, okay, the communist trade union, we follow. But and when this occurred, then all the French society went. So the journalists from the TV occupied the TV for a free TV. And even to show you, you know, how profound then the mobilization in French society was, the soccer player occupied the French Soccer Federation under the banner Soccer for the Soccer Player. Well, I mean, this is, you know, it's funny, but it's really to show you how deep, you know, in different French part of the French society, they wanted to take power about their own life. So, but there were two forces who were thinking differently. It was the leftists. They thought, where and when do we take the Winter Palace? Symbol of a revolution. And the other part who thought, this is a revolution, it was De Gaulle. He thinks when that such a general strike is, they want to take power. The communists want to take power. So they sought in power structure. It's why he went to Baden-Baden. If you remember, he flew from Paris. 2 days, nobody knew what he wanted to do. What did he want to do to negotiate with Massu in Baden-Baden, where the French soldier were in Germany? A very easy thing. He was sure that the French army will intervene if he asks it. But the other point was another one. With Massu, he negotiated the amnesty for all the far-right OAS who were condemned after the attempt of to kill De Gaulle. Because in that time, he needed a united French right against the uprising of the left, of the communists, etc. And to unite the left, the French right, you have to unite them also with the far right. And the far right was very skeptical on De Gaulle because of the Algerian war and that he gave up Algeria. So to make this, he needed Massu to give signal that he will amnesty all. And he did it half a year after 68. So this was the base for the biggest demonstration for de Gaulle, end of May. And this demonstration was very interesting because after this demonstration, de Gaulle had a genius idea to end the conflict. The genius idea was to say, after he started a lot of things, he wanted to make a referendum, and everybody said, we're not interested. He said, I dissolve the French Assembly, and I call for new election. And in this moment, the French Socialist Party, the attempt to revitalize Mendès France, didn't function. Mitterrand, who was strongly against 68, didn't exist at this moment. And so there were no socialist party, real one. There were only, and the leftists like we, in our, I will discuss this in a minute, in our thinking of the time, said election is stopping the process of revolt, so we are against election. So it was only de Gaulle against the Communist Party. And of course, two-thirds of the French who were in strike, they want everything, but not the Communist Party in power. So he won the election. It was one of the biggest win of de Gaulle in the election, because in this situation, there was no other solution for a lot of people, even being in a general strike. And this was why he politically, you know, won after 68. Now, on the other side, the society was completely shaken. And I think the greatest moment of this time, of this, was that after I was expelled, and I tell you this story not because of me, because I'm only a symbol, you know, I'm an abstraction in this, is when I was expelled, there was a big demonstration where everybody shouted, we are all German Jews. And also, if you're a little bit kitsch, you can have two or three cry. Because, look, it is 23 years after the Second World War. To say in France, we are all German, it's not natural. To say in France, we are all German Jews, is double not natural. And to say that black, white, Muslim, non-Muslim, Christian, non-Christian, whatever you want, men, women, all together have these words, means that at this moment, you had a feeling, a need of a form of solidarity, who is a solidarity who is much over what you can think emotionally about another society. A society where really everybody can be with another without and not thinking about the differences. This was a big moment. And this is really the beginning of the feeling of Europe of today. Borders, we don't care. We have today a European Union where in 27 countries you don't have any border. And in that moment, in the 60s, that was the first articulation what could be a Europe without borders. The problem is now that we had a movement, and I pretend we won culturally. We want, because the society had changed. We want socially, because a lot of things also socially change. And for God's sake, we lost politically. Why did I say for God's sake? Because, you know, we had demonstration, but not only in France, and everywhere. Freedom in the name of the Chinese Cultural Revolution. This is a certain level of madness. Or freedom in the name of Trotsky, Lenin, Stalin, Mao, another level of madness. Or you have the anarchist, les libertaires. I don't want to say libertarian because in English it's completely different in America. This movement. No, we were for Spain 36. We were for the Workers' Council 1917 against the Bolsheviks. We were for the Council in the German Revolution. We were for all the movement we have lost in history. We were the fanatic of the losers. We were very sympathetic, but always on the side of the losers. So in our political views, we were backwards in our emotion, in what this movement represent on the wall of Paris. You know, this common, it was a poem, a written poem by the unknown poet. You know, l'imagination au pouvoir, il est interdit d'interdire. You can, in all the beautiful sentence, sous les pavés, la plage, etc., il est interdit d'interdire. It's one of the most intelligent Hegelian Marxist theory, because it means it is forbidden to forbid, but it is also forbidden to forbid to forbid. Now, try to organize a society around this. Try, you know? So I think, you know, so this was the and in this time we're born a generation of not new thinker, but thinker that overcome Marxism. And you have the name. You had the name Castoriadis, Edgar Morin, Alain Touraine, André Gortz, Baudrillard. The difference, you know, Claude Lefort, etc., etc. There, so this was all Michel Foucault, and then this was the born of no way of doing, of thinking. So this was the positive side. But on the negative side, and it's why now I say forget 68. Because it's over now, baby. It's over. And now we have another time and a much, much more difficult time. Much more difficult. You know, in our time, we could say we take the world. We could say the future is ours. It's our future. We want to have the power about our future. Now, a generation today, they say we have no future. We worry about our future. Unemployment? We didn't know. AIDS? We didn't know. Global warming? We didn't know. Globalization, like it is today? We didn't know. So, you know, if today you discuss what is the legacy of the 68, forget it. 60 was, and it was in an incredible way a modernization of our societies. But in some moment, it was terrible. And I say this not because, you know, and some people say then you are a renegade. No, I'm not. I tell you, this was a great moment, and perhaps I can explain it to you like this. When you're 23 years old, a little bit younger perhaps, the first time you make love, and it's wonderful, but if it's the only one in your life, it's terrible. So you stop to live with 23. Or 22, or 21, or why, or 19. No, at this time, 18, 19 was very early. No, but take it like this. And so I want to know that this was a moment in our life. But then the life continued, and the world continued, and the society continued. But then we have to say also, which were the responsibility of our generation? For what? Negatively. And one of the negative responsibility of our generation is that coming out from this movement came out very terroristic groups and movement. And we can't say, oh no, we are the goods and the bads and nothing to do with us. This is not true. If we would say this, we would behave like our parents, not take responsibility for history. We have to take responsibility for our history. And if you put all the bad ideas, the wrong ideas were in the movement, and you make with this idea a chain, at the end, you can arrive where the Red Army fraction was, the Red Brigades in Italy, or in Japan, the Red Army. And it's very interesting. The strongest terrorist group were Germany, in Italy, and in Japan. And if you have a little historical thinking, you understand. Why? Because in this society, a plus was to fight also a fight that the parents didn't fight. And it's interesting because in France, you know, they didn't have the problem. The leftists later, they were in the tradition of the French resistance. So every French was in the resistance, you know. A debate about the collaboration, very difficult. And you know, when then we say, or I say, we have a moral responsibility, I want to make it clear with one example. Because for me, it is one of the very sad and a very explicit example. You know, Hans-Martin Schleyer was, in the 40s, member of the SS. And he was in Prague. And as a man of the SS, he was organizing the occupation of Prague. You know that in Prague, the head of the SS, Heydrich, was assassinated, 43, if I'm not wrong, by the Czech resistance. A lot of times, Schleyer was in the car with Heydrich. It could have been that he, at that day when Heydrich was assassinated, that he would have been in the car. He wasn't. So Heydrich was assassinated, Schleyer not. No, we are 35 years later. Schleyer is, like what it is, the boss. He is a social boss. He is another man. We like it. We don't like it. He is responsible for the organization for the social, more or less democratic German Republic. But it is a democracy. Now, because the Red Army want to liberate some of their comrades, they take him in as hostage. And because they didn't get what they want, they shot him in his head, in the back of a car, and then you have the reverse of the history. The victim is Schleyer. The Nazis is the Red Army faction. And then you show that you can't do politics only with a moral impetus in this. We are fighting for the better world. And to fight for the better world, we can do what we judge is necessary. You have also criteria how and what you do, even if you think you are a freedom fighter. And that from our movement, this could happen, demonstrate that in our movement, you had an incredible impulse for freedom and democracy, and you had also an impulse of a totalitarian view of society and a totalitarian view of acting. And this is also a responsibility that we take from the 60s. So when I say forget 68, I say, but don't stop to think about it. Just don't think that we are in a situation that, like this, you know, you can then renew, and then you will have in France a general strike. And now it's over. It's completely different. And you know, when you have the new movements today against globalization, this new movement, they can't, even if we should, and I am very critical about what they propose, but they are right to say globalization like it is today is unjust. We must find a social and ecological regulation of globalization. But in the 60s, a lot of people say we want a self-governed society, we want socialists, we want this. They can't say anymore this. What do they say? We want another world is possible. Yes, another world is possible. But what is this other world? How is it organized? This is a completely different question than to say, viva Mao Zedong, viva Che Guevara, or whatever. You know, this is the contradiction. And so for this, to finish, I want to say, look, when people bash the 60s, don't be afraid. And it doesn't mean when I say forget 68 that I say forget to dream. But dream the dream of today. And don't dream the dream from yesterday. Yesterday was wonderful. It's a good song. But we have found the sound of today. Thank you.
This is WBUR. You've been listening to a lecture presented by the Institute for Human Sciences titled The Legacy of 1968, A European Perspective. Speaking was European Parliament member and co-president of the Greens Free European Alliance Group, Daniel Cohn-Bendit. We began with a greeting by Institute for Human Sciences Executive Director, Irina Grudzinska-Gross. For a CD of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. You may also go to our website, wbur.org, to hear archived editions of this and all other WBUR programs. Tonight's program was produced by Michael Garth and Mike Toda with help from Rachel Paste. Our web producer is Angel Cazelli. The executive producer for Boston University's World of Ideas is Peter Lydodes. I'm Deborah Becker. Thanks for joining us.